Again, it's Saturday morning and it's time for Dr. Ross, and he's on the phone. Hello, Dr. Ross.
Lovely to talk to you, Brent.
Always lovely to chat with you, mate. We've got some listener questions as always, so let's start the segment today with those. Judith wants to know, this made me laugh, Ross. Judith said, how does daylight saving affect the human brain? She said, I cannot think of any positives for it and only ever hear people complain about that dash daylight saving, Ross.
Yeah, look, some people love it. I'd say most people love it and some of us don't. I'm not a great fan of daylight saving. I just like it when it goes dark, and I just don't like the fact that it can still be right in the middle of the summer. It can still be quite light at about 8:30, getting close to 9 o'clock. I just don't like it, but that's my own personal preference. But the way it's said that daylight saving may upset health, and some of the studies say it does this, some of them don't. But the day after daylight saving begins, so when we lose an hour, the rates of vascular disease increase about 25%. Now, that doesn't mean you've got a 25% chance of having vascular disease. You might take the risk of vascular disease in the community from, say, 5% up to 5.25%, which is a 25% increase. So it's not that big. And it's only the people who are predisposed to vascular disease. So I'll give you another example here. The day that 9/11 happened in the US, on that day, the rates of cardiac arrest around the US, not just in New York, was 7 times higher because people were scared. And that fear induced a cardiac arrest in people who were at high risk for having a cardiac arrest. So stress causes nothing but precipitates everything. So if you're at very high risk for a vascular event, such as a heart attack or a stroke, and you lose an hour's sleep and it has a significant effect on you, it can just upset your circadian rhythm, which in predisposed people may cause an issue. But for most of us, it doesn't. And interestingly, in New South Wales, where we start daylight saving, we all get a public holiday on the Monday. So therefore, people sleep in anyhow, so it doesn't really matter. The daylight saving happens on the Saturday, but you have a public holiday on the Monday, so you get a day or two to adjust to it.
Okay, yep, a lot of people do, and a lot of people don't like daylight saving, but I suppose the damn thing is we're stuck with it, Ross.
We are, but I think it's ridiculous that Queensland doesn't have it and New South Wales does. I just think that is absolutely ridiculous. And somebody came out once suggesting, who was an expert in time, suggesting we should just have a constant throughout the year, a half an hour difference all up and down the coast and in Adelaide and Northern Territory. I mean, whether that's a solution, I don't know. But personally, I'd be happy if we didn't have daylight saving, but most people enjoy it because they like the extra sunlight.
Emily is 37. Thank you for telling us your age, Emily. She says, I have a small ganglion cyst on my wrist. It does not pop up often. It's been almost 12 months since the last flare-up. Normally, I'm able to just rest and wrap it, and it goes away after a day or two.
Yep.
It came back about a week ago, and although less noticeable this time, the pain is worse. It's worse than usual, with shooting pain going down my fingers. What do you recommend to help break this down? I am not able to get into my doctor for 2 weeks. My doctor has referred me for ultrasounds before, but it has always resettled before I am able to have the scan.
That's the typical thing, but the problem is, as you get older, these things don't resolve as well. And sometimes you need to see a hand surgeon who can surgically remove the cyst, but sometimes it can still recur. So I think the best management is always conservative and just give it some time to go away. But the older you are, the longer it's going to take for the thing to resolve. And if it doesn't resolve, she does need to go and get an opinion from a hand surgeon. And what causes a ganglion? It's a bit of a tendon outgrowth. It's like a little cyst around there. And in the old days, I remember when I started medicine, we used to say the treatment of a ganglion was to whack it with a Bible and just get a little fluid out of it, because it is a very benign condition. But unfortunately, in some people, it can cause discomfort.
Trevor wants to know, he says, over the last 2 months, I've been under a large amount of stress, and when I wake up, I start to think, and then I forget what I was thinking about. He said, I looked it up on Google, the old Dr. Google, and it said, brain goes foggy with stress. Could you ask Dr. Walker about this, please?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You see, and this is the issue as we get older. People their memory isn't as sharp. And I don't know if you have this, but I at times, because my brain's pretty full with all the nonsense that I can come out with. But you'll meet someone, or you'll see someone on television. You'll say, oh, I've seen them in a movie before. What did I see them in? Or what's that person's name? And that's just, I just think that's the cumulative aspects of life. I think you probably agree with me on this one, Brent, but every year the armor gets a bit heavier in your life. And if you throw some extra stresses on top of that armor, it becomes even worse. And so therefore you just don't think as well. So people worry about, oh, I'm starting to develop Alzheimer's disease or some other dementing type illness. But often the people who are getting that don't know they have a problem with their memory. Everyone else does, but they don't. People are actually noticing that they're forgetting things and are worried about that. It's typically more just stress and age related, and it's quite normal and nothing to worry about at all. And they've studied this with brain scans, and they found on the brain scans there was no difference in the brains of people who had that symptom as opposed to people who had definite problems with short-term memory as tested on cognitive testing, and problems with thinking as well. That's a different issue altogether.
Final question, Frank. Frank is 72, and he said, I do heavy weightlifting. And he says, I mean heavy weightlifting. Could you ask Dr. Walker, the good doctor, how would that affect or postpone onset osteoporosis?
Oh, because, you see, everyone talks about osteoporosis, and if you say to most people, what's osteoporosis? I'll say weak bones. That's right. But they don't talk about sarcopenia, because sarcopenia is weak muscles as you get older. And every decade, you lose a percentage of your muscles as you from age 30. So osteoporosis and sarcopenia starts at age 30, and there's just a progressive loss. So the other day, for example, a study came out suggesting around 65% of people over the age of 50 have a degree of bone loss. It mightn't be frank osteoporosis, but what we call osteopenia. That's a lot of people. That includes males as well. So 25% of postmenopausal females have osteoporosis, 5% have osteopenia. So what the weightlifting does is keep your muscles strong, because typically your muscles are getting weaker as you get older. So if he's doing very heavy weightlifting, he's keeping the muscles strong, which then support the bones, which then keep the bones strong. So the resistance training also gives you strong bones, but also gives you strong muscles. And interestingly, though, I find this fascinating, I always say that exercise should be 3 to 5 hours a week, 2/3 cardio and 1/3 resistance training. But it's interesting that the cardio tends to reduce your risk for cardiovascular disease, whereas the resistance training also reduces your risk for cancer as well. So it's not just osteoporosis. You're getting a cancer benefit from it. So, Frank, if you can do that, keep it up.
Let's do some topics. Researchers have now found that anti-diabetes medication, of course sold under the brand names like Ozempic, may help lower Alzheimer's disease risk in people with type 2 diabetes when compared to 7 other drugs used to treat diabetes. Why is Ozempic the one that stands out, Ross?
Well, it's because of the way it works. And this was a study in 1 million people over 3 years in the US who were treated with all of these different types of diabetic drugs. So we're talking about diabetics. We're not talking about just the general population. And they found that when they looked at Ozempic versus things like insulin or metformin or Januvia or any of these other things, that Ozempic had somewhere between a 40 to 70% reduction in Alzheimer's disease over a three-year period when you compared it to the other drugs. Now, why is that? Well, a lot of people don't realize this, but part of type 2 diabetes, not type 1 diabetes, is the abdominal obesity that many people with type 2 diabetes have. And that's not just an ugly lump of lard. It's also an inflammatory organ that's pushing all this inflammation into your bloodstream. And it's also a marker for how much fat you have in your organs. So we're talking about fat in the heart. You do an autopsy on someone who's died, who's quite overweight. Half of their heart can be full of fat. You see it in the liver, you see it in the kidneys, in the lungs, and in the brain. Now, Ozempic doesn't just work by suppressing your appetite. That's one of the mechanisms of action. But it has an effect on all aspects of metabolism and takes the fat out of the system. So if you've got a bit of fat built up in the brain or in your heart or in the lungs or the kidneys or whatever, the Ozempic's going to help remove that, whereas a lot of the other diabetic drugs, for example, insulin, which is vital for people who just can't get their sugars controlled, is what we call lipotrophic, which means it build, it lays down fat, doesn't take it out of the system. And whereas a drug like metformin, which is really the workhorse drug for type 2 diabetes, is very good for the management of diabetes, and it's now being trialled around the world as an anti-aging drug. And they gave it to a bunch of type 2 diabetics, and they found that when they compared them to age-matched controls who weren't diabetics, the ones on metformin had much less heart disease and cancer than the people who weren't taking metformin who weren't diabetics. But this, these drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists like Ozempic, are really standout drugs, and I believe the blockbuster drugs of the last decade, because they've been shown in this study reduce the risk for Alzheimer's disease. In people with heart disease and diabetes, 20% reduction in heart disease. But even in the non-diabetics who had heart disease, 20% reduction in further cardiac events over 12 months, about a 20% reduction in obesity-related cancers, about a 25% reduction in progression to chronic kidney disease. In some studies, even up to an 80% reduction in fatty liver. And we really don't have any major drugs that work well for fatty livers. So, yes, they are blockbuster drugs, but they do have side effects, my friend. And we don't know what the long-term effects of being on these drugs will do. We do know in the short-term studies lasting 3 to 5 years, they do have an enormous benefit. But over 10 years, what's going to happen with these drugs? And so what I say to people who are on these drugs, who are not diabetic especially, get your achieved weight loss, lose your 15, 20 kilos over 12 months. When you want to stop them, wean off them slowly. So instead of having a weekly injection, then you might have an injection once a fortnight for 3 months, then once a month for another 3 months, then you could stop.
Can you see the day when Ozempic is taken by tablet? If you're taking less of it, is there less chance that you'll be affected by side effects?
No, potentially. I mean, that's the same with all drugs. The lower the dose, the less the side effects. And but see, here's the problem. There is a slight trend, especially if there's a family history of thyroid cancer, to thyroid cancer in people who've been on Ozempic. There is a certain, a slight but definite increased risk for pancreatitis. There's some effect on this, on gastric emptying as well. For people with problems with their eyes, there's some studies to show that it can increase the risk for eye disease. And also there's some mental health issues that have arisen as a consequence of Ozempic as well. So no one's suggesting these things are benign. There is already an oral version that's not available in Australia that some people are taking with good effect. But again, it's like anything. You line up 100 people, give them any medication at all, 90 think you're a genius and 10 want to throw them at you.
Researchers used mice to mimic human diseases and exposed them to e-cigarette aerosols. They found that vaping at a young age may raise the risk of heart disease later, especially in men. Even short-term vaping caused lung changes affecting important processes that the body needs to work properly, Ross.
Yep. Well, this is a study that they did in mice. And especially in the male mice, who they started the vaping very early in their life, because I mean a mouse lives on average around 2 years, so they start all this stuff the equivalent of teenage to young adult time in for mice, and they found that there was a marked increase in all the parameters of cardiovascular damage. So let me ask you a question, Brent. What is the biggest organ in the body?
I was going to say the skin, but is it the intestines?
No. If you're playing Trivial Pursuit, the answer is the skin, but the real answer is the endothelium, which is the single layer of cells that lines every blood vessel. It's the size of about 6 tennis courts. It's huge in everybody. And so this endothelium is really the barrier that prevents all the muck coming through your arteries, getting through the wall and setting up fatty plaques. So if you smoke one cigarette, a standard cigarette, you reduce your endothelial function by 50% for 1 hour. So some people are foolish enough to smoke 20 of those a day. But vaping causes more endothelial dysfunction than even cigarettes do. So what this is saying is that vaping probably isn't as bad for your lungs as cigarettes, but it's much worse for your arteries than cigarettes. So pick your poison is what we're saying here.
Absolutely. Just don't smoke. Just don't vape.
See, this is going to shock you, Brent, but you've got a couple of things in your chest called your lungs. They were strangely designed for a thing called breathing, not to put a white stick or some sort of thing in your mouth and suck the smoke or the toxins into your body. It's just nuts.
Catching diseases like cancer early is important for successful treatment, but not everyone has easy access to screening tests. For problems in the urinary and reproductive systems, which include the kidneys, the prostate, bladder, doctors usually use blood tests, scans, and physical exams.
And biopsies.
Now, scientists are working on a similar way to detect illnesses early through urine tests.
Yeah. See, this is the interesting thing. 15, 20 years ago, the only way to diagnose a cancer really was through a biopsy. And a biopsy can be very uncomfortable. For us wimps called men who've never been through labour, to have a prostate biopsy is excruciating. So if I was going to have one, and I don't need one, but if I was going to have one, I'd certainly have a general anaesthetic for it because it's so painful. So what we're talking about now is being able to diagnose many cancers by either a blood test called a liquid biopsy or now by a urine test where there are genetic markers in the urine or in the bloodstream if you're having a blood test of the cancer. So what happens with all cancers, Brent, is that they release into the system they're coming from, so whether it's the urinary tract or in the bloodstream, they release these circulating tumour markers because every cancer has its own DNA and RNA footprint. So they're now developing very accurate tests that'll pick up these markers very, very early on. So in the relatively near future, the screening for cancers may be just donating a bit of urine just to see whether you've got any of these markers in your urine and maybe a blood for some of the other markers for other cancers. It's really quite exciting stuff.
As we get older, managing stress becomes increasingly important for both mental and physical health. Now, there's a study that highlights the significant impact a partner's emotional well-being can have on our ability to cope with the challenges that life puts in front of us, offering insights into how relationships influence overall health and resilience throughout life. Another study telling us it's good to have a partner.
Oh, yeah. And there was a big study that I've spoken with you about before out of a little-known university in America called Harvard. For the last 80 years, Harvard had been doing this thing called the Grant Study, and that showed beyond a doubt the one key to health and happiness, more important than anything else, is to have someone else in your life who loves and cares for you, who you love and care for. And this particular study that's just come out of the University of California in Davis, just over 320 adults aged between 56 to 87, they measured salivary cortisol samples, which is a good indication of how much stress you're under, and they got people to self-report on their emotional states and their satisfaction with their relationships. So people who felt emotionally happier and had what they perceived to be good quality relationships had much lower rates of cortisol in their bloodstream. So it just backs up the long work from major epidemiologic studies like the Grant Study that the key here is if you're in happy, supportive relationships, you have much lower cortisol levels.
And last but not least, a new study shows that, is it menadione?
Menadione, that's it.
It's a synthetic form of vitamin K, also known as vitamin K3. It can slow the growth of prostate cancer in both mice and human cancer cells.
Absolutely, and the studies have shown that this might be a real bonus. But the interesting thing is, there's no menadione you can go down to your local health food store and buy, but what you can buy is vitamin K2, which I talk about all the time. The dose is 180 micrograms a day, because when menadione gets into your system, it gets converted to vitamin K2. And so they found that the menadione kills prostate cancer cells by depleting a particular fatty chemical in the bloodstream, which then stops the prostate cancer cells from dividing. So I've been saying for a long time, vitamin K2 is very good because it takes the calcium out of your arteries and puts it back in your bones. So you get two bangs for your buck. But it appears that there may be a benefit in terms of preventing prostate cancer. That hasn't been studied with vitamin K2. But as I said, when menadione gets into the body, it becomes vitamin K2.
There was a story out this week, speaking of prostate cancer, And there's talk about them not calling it prostate cancer because if you get a diagnosis of prostate cancer, it causes stress. But such a large percentage of men actually die with prostate cancer and it doesn't kill them in the end. Your thoughts on that, Ross?
Yeah, there was a big study in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years back that looked at 1,500 men diagnosed with prostate cancer. A third had a radical prostatectomy, i.e. surgical removal of the prostate. A third had radiotherapy, a thing we call brachytherapy, where they put little beads in the prostate and irradiate the prostate. And another third just had active surveillance. So no treatment, they just watched them and only intervened if there was evidence that the cancer became more aggressive. And they found that at the end of the 15 years, the survival rate across the board was 97%. But the only difference was the people with the active surveillance did have three times the rate of spread, but they still lived for that 15 years. And this is why they're now saying that maybe we shouldn't be overly and aggressively investigating and treating people with evidence of prostate cancer. And in fact, some urologists say, and others don't, some urologists say you shouldn't even have your PSAs measured because you just don't want to be fiddling, because it's only a smaller percentage of men who have the aggressive prostate cancer. But still, if you can have it cured very early by having it removed or having radiotherapy, if it's going to be aggressive, you certainly want to know that. So I don't think it's good to have your head in the sand as far as prostate cancer goes. I don't think changing the name of it matters a hang to anybody. I mean, the diagnosis is important because the management is there. But what I say to anyone who's been diagnosed with prostate cancer is get a few opinions before you embark down one line of therapy.
Always good advice from Dr. Ross Walker. Thanks, mate. We appreciate it each and every week. You have a great weekend. We will look forward to talking to you next Saturday.
Great to talk to you, mate. Thank you.